Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I'm very glad to be able to talk about St. John Henry Newman with all of you. It's a great time to be talking about St. John Henry Newman because last November, Pope Leo, our new pope, declared St. John, or elevated St. John Henry Newman to be a doctor of the church, meaning one of a small group of the most eminent teachers of Catholic thought in the whole tradition. So joining the ranks of someone like Thomas Aquinas, for example. And St. John Henry Newman is a relatively recent saint. He was canonized in 2019, despite living in the 19th century. I was actually very pleased to have been at John Henry Newman's canonization in Rome in 2019, which was a really lovely event. But tonight I'm talking about John Henry Newman on one particular topic, which is conscience, following your conscience. Okay. In a famous 1874 letter to his friend, the Duke of Norfolk, the English Catholic convert, John Henry Newman, addressed the topic of conscience, especially in relation to the authority of the Pope. At the conclusion of his treatment of conscience, Newman wrote, "I had one remark. Certainly, if I am obliged to bring religion into after-dinner toasts, which indeed does not seem quite the thing, I shall drink to the Pope, if you please, still to conscience first, and to the Pope afterwards." What does this mean, to toast first to conscience and second to the Pope? Why would Newman, now a saint and a renowned teacher of the Catholic faith, put conscience before the Pope? What exactly is conscience that it is such a great thing? Now, John Henry Newman was born into a Protestant family in the Church of England in London, the eldest of six children, in the year 1801. In the autumn of 1816, while at boarding school and just 15 years old, Newman underwent a profound religious conversion, an evangelical religious conversion, which never left him. Before this point in his life, he says that he had always acknowledged God, but with lukewarmness. He tells us that he hadn't yet seen the meaning of loving God. What's the point? But over the course of his fall semester at school, he came to a deeper and deeper awareness of the reality of an invisible and transcendent world, of the immediate and inescapable presence of God, of the value of Christian dogma, and of his own religious calling. As a result, he devoured works in the English Calvinist tradition. So firm was the young Newman's sense of this inner conversion that even 50 years later, he wrote that he was still more certain of it than that I have hands and feet. Now, this was not to be Newman's last conversion. As Joseph Ratzinger once remarked, throughout his entire life, Newman was a person converting, a person being transformed, and thus he always remained and became ever more himself. Newman shortly afterwards attended Oxford, after which he became an Anglican priest and then a fellow and tutor at Oxford, and eventually a leader in a movement called the Oxford Movement. The Oxford Movement was a reform movement centered in Oxford within the Church of England, which in the 19th century, it was in Oxford because in the 19th century, Oxford was the most important place where Anglican clergy were trained. Its goal, the goal of the Oxford movement, was to restore the Catholic character of Anglicanism, both in its liturgy, its doctrines, and its adherence to the Church Fathers. If this is unfamiliar to you, this was the way that the Oxford movement thought about things, that Anglicanism can be seen as equally Catholic to what we would call the Roman Catholic Church. For the Oxford movement, the Anglican Church was not a Protestant body, but one of three great Catholic traditions, together with the Church in Rome, that is Roman Catholics, and the Eastern Churches, that is the Eastern Orthodox. So for the Oxford movement, you have these three great branches, and recognizing this and deepening the appreciation of this is the goal of the Oxford movement, to recognize the Catholic character of Anglicanism. Now, Newman was a leading figure in this movement, attracting national attention. For Newman, though, this desire for reform was to eventually lead him out of Anglicanism and into the Catholic Church. To make a very long story short, Newman's experience of resistance within the Anglican Church to the Oxford movement, not every Anglican saw the Anglican Church as equally Catholic or as not Protestant, as well as Newman's own continued reading and consideration of the early church, eventually led him to take a retreat to a town called Littlemore, just outside of Oxford, and there he worked on one of his most important books, his essay on the development of Christian doctrine. And this eventually led him to decisively conclude that the Catholic Church, governed by the Bishop of Rome, was the true and authentic development of the earliest church. A church today no doubt changed in its appearance, its maturity, its stature from its youth, but bearing fundamentally the same identity. Now, this was a deliberation that Newman made at great lengths over many years, until it grew from a reasonable opinion to a conviction of conscience for him. And with this conviction of conscience, Newman entered the Catholic Church in 1845. For the purpose of today's talk, I think it's worth lingering on this for a moment to sort of explain why I'm giving you some of Newman's biography before we dive into Newman's theory of conscience, because it will help us remember that what Newman says about following one's own conscience was not just mere talk. Okay, it's very easy to just talk about following your conscience, but Newman actually did it. Obedience to conscience was a costly decision for Newman, especially to enter the Catholic Church at age 44, after being one of the leading members of a major movement in the Anglican Church. And this cost him greatly, and it caused him a lot of pain and suffering in his life. To sum it up very briefly, here's how Newman put it in a diary entry. He says, "As a Protestant, I felt my religion dreary, but not my life. As a Catholic, my life dreary, but not my religion." It's an unfortunate reversal here. His decision to become Catholic was rejected by his family, from whom he became even somewhat estranged. He lost almost all of his friends, and he was forced to abandon his university in Paris. You can't be a professor at Oxford anymore, especially teaching young Church of England priests, when you become Catholic. And shortly after his conversion, Newman left his beloved city of Oxford, where he had lived for many years, and it's, I think, fair to say, his favorite place in the world, for good, never returning. It says he occasionally would see the spires from the distance, but never entered the city again. Because of the prejudice against him for becoming Catholic, Newman also suffered numerous insults and injustices throughout his later life. I want to give one of the harshest examples just because I think it drives this point home. It involves a little bit of a story. In England at the time, in the 19th century, there was an ex-Catholic priest named Giovanni Achille. He had been a Dominican friar. As a priest, Achille had been probably accused of child sexual assault and was defrocked and confined to a monastery, so not a good man. But he escaped from the monastery where he had been confined, he converted to Protestantism, and that made it easier for his friends to bring him to England. Okay. And in England, Achille presented himself as a kind of martyr, a martyr against the Catholic Church, a refugee from the evils of the Catholic Church. And Achille became a prominent anti-Catholic, the kind of person you could invite to give a talk on how terrible it is to be on the inside, because he had been a Dominican friar, he would know. And Newman responded to Achille in one of his lectures, drawing attention not only to how he was wrong about the Catholic Church, but to what a horrible person he was, and not to listen to him, drawing attention to his crimes. But when this man Achille found out, although the charges were true, he sued Newman in court for libel. Because tarnished his reputation. And in England, at the time, it was required that if you were sued for libel, you needed to be able to demonstrate in court every single thing you had said. Okay. This put Newman in a difficult position. He was actually able to assemble witnesses to Achille's crime, but in the courtroom, Achille denied it, and the jury ultimately sided against Newman. Newman was forced to pay a hefty fine and legal fees equivalent to a total of £1.5 million today. He only did this because friends came to his aid. And to top it off, the judge in the case took the opportunity at the end of the trial to humiliate Newman by giving him a public lecture at length in the courtroom about how greatly his morals had deteriorated since he had become Catholic. Okay, this is an example of the kind of thing Newman's conversion cost him. Even within the Catholic Church, Newman never again enjoyed the same level of influence or prominence he had had as an Anglican. He went from being one of the most well-known men in the Anglican Church to an unfamiliar figure as a Catholic. The Catholic Church of Newman's day gave little attention to England, and English Catholics seemed fine with this one-sided arrangement. Rome doesn't pay attention to us, but we love Rome, and that's all right. They deferred heavily to Rome, relishing their distinctiveness and embracing a more Baroque style of worship. Newman's faith was fully Catholic, but he never quite aligned with the Catholic culture of England in his day. He was, for example, welcomed in the role of founding a Catholic university in Dublin, but he didn't always see eye to eye with the Irish bishops. In fact, arrangements were made for Newman to become a bishop, but it was never accepted by the Archbishop of Dublin. Probably too much suspicion on the part of Irish against the English. The Catholic hierarchy in England and Ireland, as well as the Pope at the time, Pius IX, kept a certain distance from Newman. They had a kind of suspicion of him. And this is one reason why Newman didn't become a cardinal until quite late in his life, only in 1879, after Pope Pius IX had died. Why recount these features of Newman's biography? Because, as I said, before we turn to what Newman himself thought about conscience, it helps to see that he himself was a person of deep conscience. Okay. From a young age, he sought and knew God in the innermost domain of his conscience. And he was committed to following his conscience even when it cost him dearly. Joseph Ratzinger, who I mentioned earlier, who became Pope Benedict XVI, once gave a stunning address in Dallas titled Conscience and Truth. And he focused on Newman's understanding of conscience. And Ratzinger said that Newman's life and work could be designated a single great commentary on the question of conscience. So that's the reason, I think, why we're focusing on Newman tonight for thinking about conscience. Because Newman, we could think of Newman's whole life and work as one great commentary on the question of conscience, a life and a man concerned with conscience. And what makes Newman a model of conscience, in Ratzinger's view, is that he never acquired success, public standing, or popular approval at the expense of truth. Thinking about the 19th century also brings up another important point on conscience, just to sort of frame for us before we dive into Newman's view. This was an era in which independent judgments of conscience, a view of conscience as totally independent, were increasingly and subtly divorced from any grounding in the divine or natural order. Consider an example from the famous libertarian philosopher John Stuart Mill, who was born just a few years after Newman, so same time period. Mill's most famous book is called On Liberty, where Mill wrote, "The only freedom which deserves the name is that of pursuing our own good in our own way, so long as we do not attempt to deprive others of theirs or impede their efforts to obtain it. Each is the proper guardian of his own health, whether bodily or mental and spiritual." Okay, so for Mill, the only freedom deserving of the name is pursuing your own good in your own way. That's Mill's. This leads to Mill's understanding of what good conscience looks like. Newman will ultimately call this a counterfeit vision of conscience, as merely my own light and an excuse for doing whatever I please. And yet, Newman does think there is a real freedom in conscience. And he struggled to defend that dignity and freedom without succumbing to the truth. So a little bit of background to Newman's life and the context of conscience. Newman's lengthiest and most important reflections on conscience occur in the letter I already mentioned, his 1874 letter to the Duke of Norfolk. Now, Newman wrote this letter in the aftermath of the First Vatican Council in the year 1870, because at the First Vatican Council, the Church had defined the dogma of papal infallibility. And when news of this dogma reached England, it provoked a wave of critical reactions. People did not like this, especially growing out of the liberal spirit of the age, which you could see in John Stuart Mill, as I just mentioned. And one particular critic was the former Prime Minister of England and a major politician named William Gladstone. He wrote a response titled "The Vatican Decrees and Their Bearing on Civil Allegiance." And here's what Gladstone argued. He said that because Catholics, this is Gladstone's view, because Catholics must see the Pope as infallible, they must obey his every order. As a result, Gladstone thinks, the consciences of Catholics will be so warped by their obedience to the Pope that they could no longer be trusted as loyal participants in the civic life of Britain. Okay, that's a big charge for the Prime Minister to level. After all, Gladstone alleged, if Catholics are bound to papal infallibility, then they can only ever be trusted to obey whatever the Pope tells them. And since the Pope is a foreign ruler, they can never be trusted as loyal citizens. Newman's letter addresses two issues in response: the authority of the Pope and the authority of conscience. And so those two topics will take up the rest of my talk this evening. First, Newman's view on conscience, and second, his treatment of the Pope and conscience and conflict. As the opening quotation suggested, a toast first to conscience, then to the Pope, Newman does hold to the primacy of following one's conscience, You should always follow your conscience. But this does not mean that Newman thinks a good conscience may reject the moral doctrines of the Catholic Church. As we will see instead, the primacy of conscience, that it's first, is not the same as its isolation. Newman thinks that conscience stands first over other human beings, but not first over morality or the moral law itself. Okay, this is the balance that he wants to strike. It's because conscience stands under the moral law that it stands over everyone else. We'll also have to distinguish, in order to keep this in mind, between universal moral principles, which are unbreakable, and their application in particular circumstances. Because conscience stands under the principles and laws of morality, including those sometimes taught by the Pope, it can, in some cases, stand over the orders and opinions of others. So under universal principles, over particulars, even in certain cases when those particular orders and opinions come from the Pope. And we will see that the misreading of Newman's toast to conscience is therefore not simply a misunderstanding of conscience vis-a-vis the Pope, but a misunderstanding of conscience itself. Okay. So Newman begins his response not with conscience, but with the ubiquity of law and obedience in Christian thought. He gives a long discourse on this because he suspects that the view that papal authority is a threat to conscience is capitalizing on assumption that really all law is a threat to conscience. And on the contrary, Newman reminds his reader that for any Christian, Catholic or not, conscience and authority are not the basic opposition. Scripture has laws which the Christian conscience is expected to obey, and this is not an imposition. In fact, Scripture even speaks of the good of obeying the authority in the church, okay, and the state as well. Far from being opposed to laws, Newman thinks that what's unique about conscience is that it's an immediate apprehension of the highest law itself, which is the law of God. As Newman says, conscience is a dutiful obedience to what claims to be a divine voice speaking within us. This voice is the eternal law apparent to us in our minds by the light of God. It is this voice, this law, that gives conscience its supreme authority. To borrow an expression from an excellent treatment on conscience in Newman, we can summarize Newman's view of conscience as theonomic, from the Greek words for God and law, theonomic. Conscience has an essentially theonomic character. It's under the law of God. Here's how Newman puts it at greater length. Here's his longest explanation of conscience. He says, God has the attributes of justice, truth, wisdom, sanctity, benevolence, and mercy as eternal characteristics in his nature, the very law of his being, identical with himself. And next, when he became creator, he implanted this law, which is himself, in the intelligence of all his rational creatures. The divine law, then, is the rule of ethical truth, the standard of right and wrong, a sovereign, irreversible, absolute authority in the presence of men and angels. This law, as apprehended in the minds of individual men, is called conscience. And though it may suffer refraction in passing into the intellectual medium of each, it is not therefore so affected as to lose its character of being the divine law, but still has the command of obedience. Conscience, as Newman summarizes it, is the voice of God, not a literal voice, nor a voice of new revelation, but a voice analogously, insofar as the character of God is apprehended by our minds in such a way that it seems to speak to us at every moment of action. It's like a voice, like the voice of God. And although our conscience can be distorted, just as any image may be reflected better or worse, depending on the quality of the mirror, insofar as it apprehends the law of God, conscience commands total obedience. I want to pause for a moment to consider this. Why should we think, as Newman does, that conscience is a voice, is the voice of God? I don't think it's difficult for most people to accept that conscience feels like a voice. You know, we talk about listening to your conscience as if it were like a voice speaking to you. Indeed, that's how many people experience it, and that's often how we popularly imagine. Okay, think of like the voice of the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other, like two voices competing. For many people, however, conscience is like a voice, but not like the voice of God. It's the voice of my own reason, or the voice of society, but internalized within, or it's the voice of biology, the voice of evolution, the residue of evolutionary impulses deposited within me. Let's unpack these for a moment. For some people, conscience is just the light of my own reason, reminding me of my own moral principles. Okay, the first few. If I've long decided not to be the kind of person who would lie, then when faced with an opportunity to lie, My conscience, my moral compass, speaks up. For others, conscience is just the internalized commands of society. I'd say we're highly social animals. We hate to disappoint other people. We hate to feel anyone else's shame. And so the stern voices of others, my parents, my teachers, my friends, my culture, they get lodged into our minds. On this view, the voice of conscience telling me that I must not lie or that I must pay my taxes is just the distant echo of my family or culture telling me so. Their words coursing through the circuits of my brain, which fearfully imagines that they're just over my shoulder, ready to scold me. On that view, that's what conscience is. It's just the voice of society. Or the voice of conscience is thought to be the internalized voice of evolutionary impulses. Now, I suppose this view could be quite similar. It's because some would say that we're animals hardwired for social bonds or for some degree of a certain way of life that my conscience tells me not to betray my friends or not to betray my spouse and so on and so forth. So why think of conscience as the voice of God? Well, conscience itself is not a rational argument for the existence of a divine law. Okay. But conscience does give all of us a firsthand experience which suggests the divine law. And that suggestion has to do with the way the laws experienced by conscience come across to me in my experience as absolute. And thus is having this superhuman above me quality. And if above me, then irreducible to my reason or society or biology. When my conscience, for example, recoils at the thought of taking an innocent human life, I seem to come in contact with a law that doesn't just appear to be a convenient human construct, but a law that I can't change, that's above me, that I'm subject to. Now, of course, people violate this law all the time, and cultures make whole rituals out of breaking it. But to focus again just on the experience of conscience, it seems to many of us easier to explain these crimes, these like the taking of innocent life, as a violation of conscience, rather than to deny the firmness with which my own conscience recoils from it. Okay, my conscience seems unbending. Even if I can't explain what leads others to break their conscience, my experience of conscience is that I can break it, but it still stands there. And if conscience were just the law of my own reason, you might wonder too why it doesn't feel easier to revive. Why we feel so bound to obey it. And if I truly accepted that the voice of conscience was just a product of evolution, then any mature human being, any grown-up would know that it could be readily discarded, just like a child's fear of the dark or an animal's instinct. Byproducts of evolution are real, but we relate to them very differently than to conscience. Conscience binds us even when no one is watching. That seems, again, like a peculiar experience. That is, my experience is that conscience doesn't just tell me what I'd like or dislike to do. I think this is an important difference. An evolved feeling, like an affection for my children, might tell me what I like or dislike. But conscience tells me what I should do, whether I like it or not. It's easy enough to explain how centuries of evolution might press a man to settle down and feel more gentle and affectionate and faithful to his wife and children so that he doesn't leave them. You can explain these affections. But conscience seems to tell us what he must do, that he must not leave them, even if or when he doesn't feel gentle, affectionate, and faithful. This seems to be one of the differences in our experience of conscience. Even more, I think, the laws we sense through conscience, we take to be universal laws, binding on me and also on you, binding on the present and also on the past. Consider the experience of people sometimes have of being haunted by their conscience years after the fact, even if no one knows about the evil I've committed. No one is around to shame me, no consequences now exist, and yet my conscience still seems to speak to me. Why would conscience do this unless it were testifying to a law above and beyond it? I think the hardest view to respond to is the one that conscience is merely social norms that I've taken in. And the reason it's hard to respond to is that conscience is taken in by social norms. Our society and culture makes a huge difference in the instruction of our conscience. Hence, very often, and rightly so, the voice of conscience will sound like the voice of our parents, priests, or friends. And yet, as we mature, sometimes the voice of conscience will teach us to disagree with the voice of our parents, priests, and friends. And when it does, the only justification for following it would be that it reflects a voice above them all. Indeed, we hold a great admiration for those conscientious objectors who, like the German men and women who refused to submit to the Nazi regime, disobeyed the voice of society because they held to conscience first. It's these cases where conscience leads one against all social convention that suggest the voice of conscience has to reflect something more. These alternative explanations are similar to points Newman himself addresses. What I've called the view that conscience is simply the voice of my own reason is very similar to what Newman calls the counterfeit of conscience, which in his view had become the dominant view in the 19th century. According to the counterfeit view, conscience is the right of acting according to my own judgment, without any thought to God at all, for each to be his own master in all things according as he pleases. This is what Newman thinks. When people invoke the rights of conscience, Newman thinks, they're not invoking the right of conscience to discern the will of God, but rather the liberty of pure human autonomy. This is what Newman thinks is very common in his day. Think of that quotation from John Stuart Mill at the start of today. Newman notes that this is a very dangerous view, a fake liberty of conscience. In the counterfeit view, conscience is still obeyed, but it's dramatically reduced and weakened because it's taken only as my own reason, my own opinion, my own voice. This is one concern Newman has, one view he's distancing himself from, what he calls the counterfeit of conscience. And Newman sees a second opposite assault against conscience, one that's concentrated, he thinks, in the university halls, not yet in popular opinion, but that he thinks is even more dangerous than the popular version, which is the other utter denial of conscience as anything besides a human invention. And this is, I think, very similar to the identification of the voice of conscience with internalized social or biological imperatives. Now, according to this view, the denial of conscience, which Newman thinks is brought up more and more in his day, according to this view, Newman says, conscience is but a twist in primitive and untutored man, an imagination, and that the very notion of guiltiness of conscience, is simply irrational on account of our biological nature. While the counterfeit, on the one hand, obscures conscience, this other view, that conscience is imaginary, utterly destroys it, and Newman thinks would cut off human beings completely from the divine law or even from any law at all. For Newman, the reduction of conscience on display in the first view, the counterfeit, has its fulfillment in the second, which is the annihilation of conscience. Since the counterfeit already admits that conscience makes no reference to the eternal divine law, Newman thinks it's only one step further to say it's really no law at all, that it's really just an illusion. It cannot be underscored enough that Newman's defense of the importance of conscience is aimed against this threat, the loss of conscience altogether, which he sees as a growing threat advocated more and more by the academics of his day. Now, I think it's this insight by Newman into this two-stage loss of conscience. You have a real sense of conscience, and then it gives way to a counterfeit sense, and then it disappears altogether. That is particularly what attracted Joseph Ratzinger's special interest in his 1991 address, the one I mentioned earlier. Because Ratzinger says that Newman anticipated the modern replacement of conscience with the concept of progress. But Ratzinger continues, when you substitute progress for truth, when you think that the standard is progress, what makes society or human beings better, the future, rather than truth, progress ultimately loses its direction and becomes nullified. For if no direction exists, everything can be progress just as well as regress. The direction becomes arbitrary. And so Ratzinger thinks, apart from the standard of truth, there's no means of distinguishing progress from regress, improvement from corruption. If you think conscience is just accords with social progress, you must ask progress to what? And this is where Ratzinger, building off of Newman, thinks the reduction of conscience, when you reduce conscience to a counterfeit, to just my own reason, and then reduce it just to social pressure, this creates a vacuum, a need to define what would fill this space where conscience used to be. And this vacuum gets backfilled with all sorts of evils, with the power of technology or social conformity or raw political power. And as a result, what Ratzinger thinks Newman was predicting, seeing into, is that the popular conscience, if it's still active but only aware of this present moment, if it's detached from any sense of a truth above itself, ready to act but unaware how, becomes a terrifying tool in the hands of any person in power who has completely silenced his own conscience. And this is what Ratzinger thinks happened in the 20th century. Ratzinger thinks it is as if Newman saw the future in the loss of conscience and the critiques that conscience was simply an illusion that would lead to the horrifying reality of the loss of conscience in the 20th century's totalitarian regimes. That's an interesting way of thinking about maybe how Newman's concern about the counterfeit of conscience and then the loss of conscience actually was somewhat prophetic. That when you lose conscience, when you lose a real sense of conscience and replace it with my own sense of conscience, when you lose my own sense of conscience and replace it with just a social convention, this actually stands behind many of the evils that Ratzinger saw looking backwards that Newman had anticipated. Okay. So to sum up, Newman thinks that conscience is the voice of the divine law, and it must be. It can't be replaced with anything else. Otherwise, it ceases to really be conscience. So if that's what the source of conscience is, what does Newman think conscience does? What is the work of conscience? People often think that conscience is how we know right and wrong, and so conscience must be the power by which we accept the divine law on Newman's God. So if one is a Christian, that would make conscience our acceptance and knowledge of God's commandments and apprehension of the principles of the moral law. It's by my conscience, you might think, that I know the golden rule to do unto others as they would do to me. But for Newman in the Catholic tradition, that's not quite right. Conscience does often remind us of laws. It hears laws, like the golden rule. But what conscience does is more specific and limited. Okay? What conscience does is apply laws to particular cases. So this is very important. If conscience receives the voice of the divine law, what it then does is apply it. That, Newman thinks, is the unique work of conscience. To use an analogy, conscience is not like a legislator or a legal scholar. Okay, it's not the part of us that decides what laws we should follow or what the law in fact is. To keep up the analogy, conscience is more like the police officer or the judge, the one who enforces the law by applying it. The legislator makes the laws, but the officer and the judge applies the law, saying, this thing right here counts as breaking the law, okay? Or this thing does not. Conscience isn't what tells me don't whine or don't gossip. Okay, conscience is what tells me in this particular moment that comment I just made was whining, or that story I was about to tell would count as gossip. So conscience applies the law to particulars. After citing St. Thomas Aquinas, here's the way Newman puts it. Conscience is not a judgment upon any speculative truth, any abstract doctrine, but bears immediately on conduct, on something to be done or not done. Conscience is always the sense of right or wrong towards particular actions, towards this act or that act. And this matches, I think, with our experience of conscience, where we experience our conscience speaking up, even unpredictably, as we're on the verge of doing something, or as we're looking back on something we've just done. So in this sense, conscience is irreducibly particular. It brings together all the details of a person's given moral situation and applies them in a specific case. And so we could say conscience is not just particular, but irreducibly particular. It doesn't get any more particular. And that feature about conscience, that it applies to the particular, okay, that applies to this moment right now. Is what I'm doing right now in accordance with my conscience or not? Or it looks forward to something I'm about to do. That particular thing, does that accord with my conscience or not? Or that thing I said this morning, was that in good conscience or not? That specific thing. It's this particularity of conscience that Newman thinks explains its power and its weakness at the same time. Newman calls it the highest of teachers and the least luminous, the darkest, the least bright of all. It's the highest of teachers because it's the voice of God and the singular felt pressure urging us to do what's right and provoking us against what's wrong. Nothing substitutes for a missing conscience in the moral life. No one outside of you can take the place of your conscience. No one outside of you can do the job that your conscience alone can do, because only your conscience speaks to your life. Your life in the sense of all its details. Okay. Every single detail of the experience. Only your conscience sees from within. Everyone else sees from without. And so no external agent can replace the internal work that conscience does in conforming us to the moral law. People can teach, but only your conscience can speak within. Moreover, the power of conscience lies precisely in its extension to the most particular aspects of my life, because nothing speaks to these particularities other than my own conscience. That's the power and importance of conscience. Okay? Principles and laws of morality, a principle like do good, not evil, or love your neighbor as yourself, or a law, do not take the name of God in vain. These speak to universal situations, but conscience applies them to particular cases. That this person is my neighbor, this person is owed my love, or these words count as taking God's name in vain, or don't. That particular application is the very stuff of the moral life, and it's why Newman thinks conscience is so important. And yet conscience's weakness is also here, because it gets stretched to every concrete particular thing. And it reveals, as Newman puts it, that it is so delicate, so fitful, so easily puzzled, obscured, and even perverted. And moreover, Newman thinks, because conscience is all about particulars, it stands downstream of how well you grasp moral principles and how committed you are to them in the first place. So if you don't know moral laws or moral principles, or you're not really committed to them, conscience won't help to take its place. Now, conscience can surprise us. It can tell us more than we thought we knew, but it's not like it's a direct line of communication to God. You can't pick up the phone of conscience and ask God to speak to you directly. That's why the voice of God is an analogy. It's a metaphor for what conscience is like. And so conscience is always in need of instruction and aid. Conscience can be counted on to light up when a particular act would be boastful. Conscience says, don't do it. That would be boasting. But it lights up much more reliably and much brighter with practice. And it may not light up at all if I've convinced myself that boasting actually isn't that bad. In short, then, for Newman, conscience is at the center of our moral life and our relationship with God, because it's by conscience that we apply our apprehension of divine goodness, justice, and sanctity, in sum, the law of God's being, to all the actions of our lives. As Ratzinger puts it so aptly, for Newman, conscience is the middle term between authority and subjectivity. Our consciences are how we apprehend the truth of what we ought to do. And thus the centrality of the concept of conscience for Newman is linked with the centrality of the concept of truth, namely the moral truth of the divine law, which we apprehend through our conscience. I want to say a little bit now about how Newman's specific treatment of how conscience can come into conflict with the Pope is a useful test case for his overall theory. Because Newman's very clear that the Pope's moral teachings are binding. On the one hand, but also he thinks that there are certain circumstances in which one can justifiably disobey the Pope. That's very interesting. How could this be the case? Now, Gladstone had claimed that Vatican I's definition holds that no one can disobey the Pope without risking his salvation. But Newman clarifies that it only says no one can disbelieve the duty of obedience and unity without such risk. So Newman distinguishes between disobeying the Pope and disbelieving the duty to obey, calling the latter necessary, not the former. So does this entail that any instance of disobedience can be justified in the name of conscience? Or that one could maintain a kind of spirit of obedience, even while occasionally disobeying in practice? Newman replies that the reason for the focus on belief in the duty of obedience is not because obedience is optional, but because we must first recognize the scope and significance of the Pope's authority. Okay. Gladstone had claimed that the Pope has authority over basically everything, and so Gladstone thought he was a kind of tyrant, that he had a kind of limitless authority. And Newman replies first that the Pope's authority is not so broad. Okay, that the Pope has internal authority in the Church. He doesn't have authority like a ruler outside of everything. He doesn't have authority. He has authority over the Church's worship, its liturgy, its interior government, but he's not a replacement for other national governments. And the second thing Newman says is that the Pope's authority is not equal in every area, nor is it equally infallible in every case. And so Newman says we have to zoom in on what exactly the Pope's authority looks like. And to do that, he offers a couple hypothetical situations which he thinks are unrealistic, but nevertheless feels compelled to offer for clarity. And we can detect in these examples a distinction between the Pope's infallible authority regarding faith and morals and his fallible authority elsewhere. That he doesn't make mistakes here, but he does make mistakes there. Or even areas where the Pope has no authority. So Newman imagines the first scenario. He says, suppose, for instance, an act was passed in Parliament bidding Catholics to attend Protestant service every week. So imagine that the English government said Catholics have to go to Protestant services. And the Pope said not to do so, for it was to violate our duty to faith. If this happened, Newman says, I should obey the Pope and not the law, not the law of England. Or to give an alternative example, Newman imagines, again, were I a soldier or sailor in Her Majesty's service and sent to take part in a war which I could not in my conscience see to be unjust, and should the Pope suddenly bid all Catholic soldiers and sailors of England to retire from the service, here again, taking the advice of others as best I could, I should not obey him. This is interesting. One case where Newman thinks you would obey and another where you weren't. Were the Pope to forbid Catholics from attending Protestant service, the reason is it would be because his prohibition was couched as a duty to our faith and thus intrinsic to faith and morals. Here the Pope is owed full obedience, not because of his own character or prudence, but because the matter at stake is one of Christian faith. But in the second case, the case where Newman thought you could disobey the Pope, you could disobey the Pope when he said, you know, all English sailors need to go home. They can't participate in this war against France. In the second case, the Pope's not issuing a judgment about faith and morals. On the contrary, Newman stipulates that in this example, it's one in which I could not in my conscience see the war to be unjust. Okay, so it's not about the justice of the war, it's this particular case. So the first case belongs to the Pope's infallible authority in relation to the Church, teaching the moral law. But the second does not. The second is a particular application. The second case concerns a specific instance of the moral law concerning just war, while the first case is simply about the law of worship itself, or a law itself. As Newman explains later in the letter, a genuine collision between conscience and papal authority is never possible in matters of moral principle, which conscience is not suited to object to. So when the Pope teaches something as a moral law, conscience isn't in a position to object. A conflict is only possible if the Pope were to command a particular practical command. Do this thing, don't do that thing, given your circumstances in your case, which is the proper domain of conscience. And in these cases, Newman cites respected theologians for his view that it could be the case, if one had very good reason in keeping with the moral law, that the Pope could be disobeyed. He even cites papal defenders like Cardinal Bellarmine from the 16th century. And in this area, when it comes to practical matters, practical judgments, do this thing, don't do that thing, in your specific case, apply the law in this way, in your case rather than in that way in somebody else's, popes not only can err, but frequently have in history, all the way back to the example of St. Peter, which Paul recounts in Galatians. But it's only in these cases regarding the non-infallible authority of the Pope that true conscience can rightfully object, and it's because of the proper domain of conscience having to do with particulars. Even in these cases, though, Newman thinks the burden for disobeying the Pope is on the side of conscience. Such a person, Newman notes, must be able to say himself, as in the presence of God, that he simply can't do what he's been commanded. Apart from such a conviction of conscience before God, such a firm conviction before God, I cannot do it, one must assume as a bounden duty that the Pope is right to act accordingly. Even here, though, this fits perfectly with what we've seen Newman say about conscience, that having taken in the divine law, it applies it always to concrete and new situations. So in conclusion, in what way is conscience primary for Newman? It's because all moral instruction depends for its efficacy on the conscience and on the internal disposition to absorb, obey, and feel bound by its instruction. Conscience must be primary, Newman thinks, because were it not for human conscience, all of the Pope's teaching would be in vain, as if one were trying to catechize rocks, which have no conscience, or give moral counsel to animals by saying, just listen to that voice within. Come on, you know what it's like, that have no faculty of hearing it. Hence, Newman praises conscience first. He gives the toast to it, because while conscience surely benefits from the Pope's teaching, people can have consciences even without the Pope. But the Pope needs conscience. While we can say that conscience needs the Pope in practice, in light of its weaknesses, it doesn't need the Pope in principle. someone who's never heard of the Pope can still follow their conscience. They might not do so well. Maybe they do so well. But on the contrary, the Pope needs conscience in principle, because everything the Pope teaches, everything the Church teaches, everything Scripture teaches presupposes it. Anytime you hear someone teach you a moral law from without, it always presupposes that you have some sense of obedience within. As Newman puts it, were the Pope to condemn true conscience, he would be cutting the ground from under his feet. With a compelling portrait of the work of conscience, Newman says the following: it's by the universal sense of right and wrong, the consciousness of transgression, the pangs of guilt, the dread of retribution, as first principles deeply lodged in the hearts of men. It's thus, and thus only, that the Pope has gained his footing in the world and achieved his success. This description is the true meaning of conscience, at which point we can truly see that Newman's rhetoric has meant simply to remind us of what should be patently obvious about conscience, that conscience is only intelligible as presupposing moral truth, that moral truth is its only standard, no different from the way a compass only works if we imagine an actual magnetic north, and that conscience has primacy over the Pope, not because it has primacy over moral truth, but because it's about moral truth that the Pope is speaking. Hence, every papal teaching presupposes and speaks to conscience. The primacy of conscience is not meant to absolve conscience of its duty before God, but to protect conscience from the temptation to forsake its duty. And so Newman toasts first to conscience. But presumably, the Pope toasts first to conscience too, since in no other way has God arranged for human beings to hear and obey him from within. It's thanks to conscience that the human person receives the teachings of the Church, or even as of the Pope, as not just good advice, but as binding, and is motivated to obey it not simply as an external authority, but as being in accord with truth. I'd like to conclude with two very practical points: what Newman has to say about how to form your conscience, and why to follow one's conscience. Hopefully these can be quick. First, what advice can we see from Newman about forming one's conscience? Now, this is not a quick topic. The conscience needs to be formed both from outside in and the inside out, so to speak. It takes a lot of work to form your conscience, and it requires taking a lot of things into play. For Newman, the commandments of God in Scripture and the interpretations of them given in the moral teachings of the Church, so what the Church teaches about the moral life, they're an indispensable starting point. Knowing what the Church teaches about the moral life, for Newman as a Catholic, form the parameters of a Catholic conscience. They form it from the outside in, so to speak. But Newman also thinks the conscience needs to be formed from the inside out, needs to be formed by inwardly cultivating virtues, like love, and by prayer. That is, continually holding up moral choices to God, asking, God, what should I do? These virtues form the conscience from the inside out. But as we've seen, the whole point of conscience is that it concerns particular acts. So no matter how much you form your conscience, you still will be faced with the particularities of what about this case. Conscience doesn't evaluate moral laws, like the golden rule, as I've said. Conscience takes moral laws and evaluates particular circumstances. And often these particular circumstances become quite complex. Can I work at this company in good conscience? Should I break this promise I made to a friend? I know I shouldn't break promises, but this one seems different. Do I owe my parents obedience in this matter? I know I owe my parents obedience, but what about in this case? Would it be a violation of conscience to do it? And very frequently, Catholics will find when the moral teaching of the Church does not weigh in on the specific question I'm facing, that their consciences might feel divided. You might find yourself not knowing what to do, feeling torn in different directions. Though I do think it's worth clarifying that an undecided conscience is not the same as a divided conscience, okay, or feeling divided against a firm conscience. There are times when the reason we feel inwardly divided is that our conscience clearly points in one direction, even though our thoughts or desires point in another. Okay, so that's a different case. Just because I can come up with good reasons to lie to my friend, he'd be happier if he didn't know, doesn't mean that those are good reasons. A ship's captain answering a distress call might know in conscience that he has to do it, even though he feels divided because of the burden it will place on him and his crew. But that's not a divided conscience. He's divided, but his conscience isn't. Conscience is clear. Okay. So there are cases when our conscience is clear, but we feel divided. But that's very different than a case
where our consciences seem to be aware of competing duties, where we're actually not sure in good conscience what to do. As a parent, for example, my conscience might at one moment tell me that I have a duty to correct my children for their bad manners. But at the next moment, it might remind me that I also have a duty to be gentle and forgiving. Maybe then I can pass over some small mistake. So what do we do once our consciences are formed when we're not sure how to act? Okay, when we've taken the steps to form our conscience, but we're not sure how to act. Now, at one point in the letter to the Duke of Norfolk, Newman imagined how he would deal with a serious crisis of conscience if he were commanded to do something he thought were wrong. He says he would take the following steps. I should look to see what theologians could do for me, what the bishops and clergy around me, what my confessor, what my friends whom I revered would say. Know how much Newman imagines he would do to let his conscience take in the wisdom of others. Okay, after we formed our consciences by the knowledge of God, exteriorly knowing what God's law is, interiorly by cultivating prayer and love, a well-formed Catholic conscience is always looking to the advice of others. Those who are learned in theology, to the clergy, to spiritual directors, to confessors, and as Newman says, especially to friends. Okay? I think it's a particularly bad sign if we feel we're not really sure what our conscience would do, but we're embarrassed to bring it up in front of our friends because it would be obvious then what we should do. That's often a case that we already know in advance what we should do. It's a great practice to be able to bring our moral dilemmas to our friends, to bring them transparently before them, people we trust. And we may even find that there are cases when we disagree and we have to follow our consciences even against the advice of our friends. But Newman, I think, is particularly helpful in recommending that you bring your conscience before the advice of others. You not just leave it trapped inside yourself. So that's one point of practical advice from Newman. After you've taken the right steps to form your conscience, be always forming it by bringing it before, by having good friends, by having friends that you can bring, having good mentors, but also good friends you can bring into your conscience. The second practical point, the final one that I want to deal with, why is it worth following one's conscience? Why is it so important to always obey one's conscience? There's one short answer that rang through Newman's mind in his own deepest moments of discernment. This phrase that he repeats in various different cases. Time is short, but eternity is long. Interesting expression that Newman likes. Time is short, but eternity is long. Now remember, as I mentioned at the start of the lecture, Newman began his essay on the development of Christian doctrine, the one that led him to become Catholic, in order to help settle his own discernment. When he began writing the essay, he was still an Anglican. He was aware of good reasons to become Catholic, but he didn't yet think that his conscience told him to. He needed to know that becoming Catholic was not merely an option, but a requirement. He needed to know that it was a conviction of conscience. But once he becomes convinced that the Catholic Church is the Church of Christ, he cannot help judging the voice of God beckoning him. And when he does, it is love that calls him forth. It's love that brings him to follow his conscience. There's a novel Newman wrote. Newman also wrote these novels, which are an interesting feature of his life. A novel called Callista. And in the novel Callista is about this early Christian convert named Callista. And Callista says this to a friend about why she's being so drawn. She says, my nature feels toward it, towards what she's being drawn to, the Christian faith ultimately, as towards a person. When I obey it, here I think she's speaking of the voice of conscience. When I obey it, I feel a satisfaction. When I disobey, my conscience, a soreness, just like that which I feel in pleasing or offending some revered friend. You will say, who is he? Has he ever told you anything about himself? Meaning, has God ever spoken to you directly by your conscience? Alas, no, Callista says. He hasn't spoken to me in that way. The more's the pity. But I will not give up what I have, what I hear in my conscience, because I have not more. The echo I hear implies a voice, and a voice implies a speaker, and that speaker I love and fear. So what moves Newman to follow his conscience? It's these two, love and fear. Love of God, whose voice we hear, and the fear of losing him, should we weakly prefer ourselves. Love of God who lasts forever, eternity is long, and fear of choosing what is convenient for a passing moment. Time is short. And so Newman ends his essay on development with the following sober words. He turns to the reader. He's written this whole book, and now he addresses the reader. He says, now, dear reader, time is short, eternity is long. Put not from you what you have here found. Regard it not as mere matter of present controversy. Set not out resolve to refute it, looking for the best way to do so. Do not wrap yourself in the associations of years past, nor determine that to be truth which you wish to be so, nor make an idol of cherished anticipations. Time is short, eternity is long. Those are the last words of the whole book. This is, I think, Newman's best, or at least his most pithy, reason for following conscience. And it's why he followed conscience in his own case. It's why he followed his conscience even in the most eventful decisions of his life. If conscience really does convey the voice of the divine, then it's the voice of someone who sees from an eternal perspective. Why would we risk to lose this one? What could we gain better than him? For Newman, following conscience, a conscience subject at all times to the moral law, is like the life of faith itself. Newman thinks faith is a venture, even a risk, but one where I put all my chips in. The one who surrenders to conscience puts all his chips in. He gives himself wholly to the venture. But the reward is well worth it. Of all the advantages that could stack up to disobeying conscience, maybe I disobey my conscience and I experience some pleasure or some ease, some comfort, some security. All of these things that I could gain for that moment of disobeying conscience are in the end of time, and thus short. So why should we follow our consciences? For Newman, it's because time is short and eternity is long. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.